Station number 14977, Ernest Harvey, Reel 5.
Mr. E. Harvey, Reel 5. You were set aside and told to go to hospital, Mr. Harvey. What happened?
Yes. Eventually, I went into Bishop Auckland EMS hospital, and it was there that I had an operation for a hernia. And the doctor who did it actually was a German. It was a German doctor, and all the time I had it, I was conscious. So all the time I had the operation, he gave me a spinal injection, and I was surrounded by nurses and doctors, whatever, who was watching the operation. And after the operation, I was fine, and I just went back into the ward, and I was conscious all the time. And it's a funny thing, but there was Italian prisoners of war in the hospital at the time I was in, and there was one in the next bed to me, and we had quite a big chat. And I remember after that, I think I was transferred to a convalescent home.
Was it a military hospital, this?
Well, yes, I think it was, well, it was both civilian and military hospital. But before I could have the operation, I remember, my dad had to come through and sign for the operation, because at that time I wasn't, I think he had to be over 21. And he had to come through and sign before I could have the operation, which he did do. But it was both, I think, to my knowledge, it was both civilians and military.
Was the regime very strict, being a patient?
No. The food was quite good. Everything was more or less normal. No, I didn't find anything different about the hospital.
You said that you got close to one of the Italian prisoners. What kind of things was he telling you?
Well, actually, I just learned a little bit of Italian from him, and after that, I wish now that I'd learned more. As years went by, I went into Italy.
He didn't give you any indication that he was pleased he was out of the war?
Oh, he was pleased. Oh, he was very pleased he was out of it. I mean, he was delighted to be out of it. In fact, there was a few of them in there, and they were all happy to be out of it. Well, I think all the Italians were.
The convalescent home you went to, where was that?
I went to this convalescent home, I think this was at Halifax, because I remember it was on the top of a hill. And at the convalescent home there, where we started off just doing walks every day, and the food was very good, and then we started doing PT, remedial PT, which was more or less tummy exercises to strengthen the you know, where you'd had your operation up.
Was this a military convalescent
home? It was a military convalescent home, yes.
Other ranks, or were the officers there?
Oh, there was all ranks there. It's quite a mixture.
What date would this be?
This would be... I think it would be November. Yeah, I think it would be November 43. I think this would be, approximately, the end of November. Because it was after that I was transferred to, I think it was to the 45 Div, which was a more or less a holding battalion where we went to. But they were nearly all Germans who I was with, all the Allied chaps.
How long had you been in the convalescent home?
Let's see, what, about 4 or 5 weeks.
And were you allowed to relax? Was it easy going?
Oh yes, it was quite all right there. There was no problems.
Were you wearing the blue of the...
No, I was wearing just the GLI uniform then at the convalescent home. More or less when you were in hospital, that's when you wore blue. But we didn't wear blue, mine, when I was at Bishop Auckland. Because I wasn't there long enough, really.
5 or 6 weeks in the convalescent home would bring it up close to Christmas, did it?
It would do, yes, because I remember I spent Christmas in Lincoln. And the officers, I remember, that's where I was at Lincoln, with all the Allied chaps I was with. It was like a holding battalion, but attached to 45 Div. And the officers, I remember, came round and there was just the meals out, which was a regular thing then, the officers giving you your meals.
You hadn't been given any leave to go home after your convalescence?
I may have had a week's leave. I'm not certain. I may have had a week's leave, and then, as I say, I went to the 45 leave.
When you moved to the attachment from the convalescent home, had you been medically examined again and graded?
Yes, I've been graded B1.
What did that exactly mean as regards getting back to your unit?
Well, it didn't mean anything. I mean, the B1 was just next to A1, so it was just straightforward going back to where you started from. That was no problem.
In Lincoln, where you were this holding battalion, where was it?
I remember it was like a small school where we were billeted in, and of course it was a nice hut, and I remember at the time Charlie Eagles was with me. Well, Charlie Eagles now, he has a photographer's shop in Sunderland, in Blandford Street, Sunderland. He was with me at this place in Lincolnshire, and we used to go out every day, drilling, route marches, and that's where we learned to fire the peat, because I remember going into this field, and we had a large stump of a tree, and each of us had to learn about the peat, which of course we did. Then it was from there we went on longer route marches. In fact, there we went on a route march, I think it was about 100 and so many miles in about 5 days, and we finished off street fighting in Hull.
The peat, first of all, what was it like?
Well, the peat, I would say, what, about three foot long, and weight, I would think, what, maybe 9 or 10 pounds, and they used to be like a shell. One chap used to carry these like shells for the peat, and he was like number two, and he used to load the peat, and then you used to fire it. And of course, you fired it from the you learnt to fire it from the ground and also from the shoulder, standing up. But if you fired it standing up, you got a heck of a kick. And it was very dodgy.
How did it fire? Where did the shell go?
The shell went in the front, was put in the front, and then you fired it from behind. If my memory serves us right. Yes.
And you were saying this had quite a terrific kick.
Oh, yes, yes, a recoil to your shoulder when you fired it.
Were you also trained what part of a tank to aim for where it would have the greatest effect?
Well, I think we were more or less aimed to try, if possible, at the side, but the point was, with the peat, you had to get about 30 yards, really, to the tank, at least, before it had a good effect. You know, I mean, from 100 yards, well, it was no good. You had to be close, I mean, 20 to 30 yards, and you had a chance of knocking the tank out.
You would have to have quite a bit of nerve to wait that long.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I don't think that, I've never known that, that never came about.
Was it a good weapon at close range?
Well, at close range, if you could get that close, but personally, I think it was a waste of time. It might have been all right if you were in a position, you know, to fire the peat, you wanted to get in position, but, I mean, Jerry would never let you get in that position to fire the peat. You know, I mean, it's all right saying you've got to get down, the one's got to load it, and by the time you load it, well, you'll have been knocked out. I mean, it's all right if you can get behind a hedge and the tank's at the opposite side, then you've got a chance of knocking the tank out. But if you're going into an attack and you think you're going to use a peat, well, I think you can forget about it.
You said you were doing street fighting in Hull. What is the technique of street fighting?
Well, what we used to do, one used to kick the door in and throw the grenade in, and then the other one would dive in. He'd spray the room with bullets, and then we'd do the next one, or toss it through the window, and then one would go in through the door. But we had sort of a we sort of two of you work together. One opened the door and the other one tossed the grenade in, and you followed in after the grenade. But we use a lot of phosphorus bombs then. Well, I wouldn't say a phosphorus, but the sort of flash, a heavy flash, you know. In fact, I remember they used to go out into the rivers and they used to toss them into the rivers to stun the fish, you know, and catching fish with them. That used to be a regular thing, like if they had any, kept one or two back, that's what they used to do with them.
So you work very closely in pairs?
In pairs, when you were street fighting. Yes.
You say bursting and sprayed bullets around the room. What weapons were you using?
Well, one would... we had Sten guns. They might seem effective then, but quite frankly, if I found out later in life that they were no use. At the time, it might have seemed all right. Dashing the door open and spraying it with a Sten gun might seem all right, but I think your grenades did the trick. Like, it stunned the opponents, and after your grenades, I don't think there was any need for you to spray it. But the Sten gun bullets, well, to me, they weren't effective.
In what ways were they ineffective?
Well, I remember later on when I was in Normandy, I was with Charlie Passfield, and one of our officers, he had this Sten gun, and we were both on stand two, and where we were, this officer hadn't seen Charlie, and he must have mistook him for a jury, and he fired the whole mag of a Sten at Charlie, and I was saying, you silly bee, and he sprayed Charlie, and anyway, Charlie went on the bottom, and I remember saying, Ma, if it's happened to him, I says, you've had it. Unfortunately, Charlie got up, and there was nothing wrong with it at all. All that the Sten gun bullets had done was just upset his magazines and his pouches. But he was all right. But if the Sten gun had been any good at all, I think it would have finished him. And that's how I found out eventually. I think the Sten gun, it wasn't very effective.
And it had any other major faults?
Yes, you had to be careful how you put it, because if you stood on the bottom, it would spring up, and the safety catches didn't always work on the Sten gun.
Would it hit the bottom or something?
Hit the bottom, yes. If you put it down, you had to be careful how you handled it. More or less, to be make sure the Sten was safe, you had to take the cartridge out.
How was it fed, cartridge-wise?
Well, just like in the centre, similar to a rifle, but smaller. But it was a long case which pushed in. And maybe 50, to my knowledge, maybe 15 or 20 rounds in the Sten, but there were smaller bullets altogether.
Were there any other weapons coming in? This is early 1944. Were there any other weapons you were using?
Well, we used the mortars, and then there was the we had the Tommy, call them a Tommy gun, there isn't another name for them. But those were good if you could get a hold of one, but those were in short supply.
Were these American?
No, this was a British gun. I forgot the name of it now. But the Sten gun, the Sten gun was all metal, you know. But this other gun, what do you think the name of it? It had a wooden barrel, you know, but it was really high class compared to the Sten. There was no comparison of the two. But as I said, we found out later what you really wanted in action. You wanted automatic weapons. Even your rifle was no good. What you wanted was automatic weapons to blast the hedges with.
The training that you were getting with this holding unit was pretty hectic.
It was pretty hectic. You can imagine, it was like travelling day and night, you know. And we were travelling all day and then just sleeping rough on a night time. Of course, our gas capes come in handy because it was absolutely tossing it down in some parts then. But a mobile unit would... meet us up and supplies with food, which was hot, which we needed, and also there would be a lorry with our overcoats and a blanket. In the, it carried the wagon used to carry our overcoats and a blanket in the lorry, you know, in the large pack.
Was there still a light infantry training you were getting?
Oh yes, we were still all DLI.
You were all DLI?
Yes, all DLI, yes.
What was your living accommodation like in Lincoln?
Where we were, it was quite good. It was quite good. It was like an old barn, but it was really good. Of course, we had double bunks, you know. Fortunately, I was on the bottom this time. And the officers were quite good. There wasn't the spit and span as what there was in the past. You know, all that had gone now. We were really doing the rough stuff. It was all hard, solid training. You hadn't time to spit and polish anything like that then. You were out on the road every day.
You said you were B1 when you started. Were you getting medicals to check how you're coming on?
No, I didn't have normal medicals. No.
You don't recall the actual name and number of your unit?
No. It's 45, Dave, I know. Maybe my army paperwork, lad. I remember having a 45 medical review, and I think I was graded B1.
Were there any other people that you were meeting for the first time that became close to you?
No, there was only Charlie Eagles, I think, really, who was the other chaps. Well, I mean, I knew them all by name, Bill Hart and one or two more, who later I met in the 9th Battalion.
How long were you with this unit?
Oh, trying to think. Well, it was after that when we must have been together a good few months, about 3 or 4 months.
In the very early part of 1944.
44, yeah. Because it was after that when we all joined the 9th Battalion at Saffron Walden. We transferred there because I went to Saffron Walden, Charlie Eagles and Bill Hart, and that's when we went into Captain Williams' platoon.
Was this all of you in that unit, or just
a
number of you?
No, just a number of us, But there was a few of us all went into this S platoon.
Do you recall the date that you joined the 9th?
I can't recall the date, no. Probably know if I had the books and that.
What were you doing in this S platoon?
Well, in S platoon, as I said, our officer was a Captain Williams. Sergeant Blenkinsop, he was the platoon officer. I can't think of the corporal's name. And S platoon, well, what we used to do, we used to go out blowing pill boxes. We used this new plastic plastic explosives. We were using this and learned how to blow pill boxes and how to take 25-pound guns across the rivers.
And plastic explosive. How yes. did you manipulate that? How
well,
did it work?
Well, you used to have these detonators, and then you used to put a detonator in, and I think you used to, with the wire, and then they used to set them off like that, the detonators, stick the detonators in the explosive.
Could you work this material like clay?
Yes, you could just work it like clay, and of course, mine, I never handled it. I always remember it used to be always Sergeant Blenkinsop who used to always handle the explosives. I used to always puzzle about that. But I think he was being careful. He didn't want any accidents, and he seemed to know exactly what he was doing. And I remember he used to go out and practice and what damage the explosive would do, and all such as that. And then,
did you come up with some way or better way of blowing pill boxes?
Well, I mean, you could use the paint gun if you could get close enough. That was another solution. Of course, the artillery, I think that's what did the job, really.
Laying a plastic explosive to blow up a pillbox, where would you lay it in relation to the pillbox itself?
Well, to my knowledge, I was always at the bottom. it seemed to know exactly where to put it at the bottom, and it used to go straight through. It used to, the explosive went inwards, it didn't come out over.
Was it particularly effective?
Oh yes, it was quite effective. Yes, very effective. And then we also had to learn how to lift mines, mine lifting.
How was this done?
Telemines. Well, what they used to do, they used to go out in the field, so many of them in the platoon, they used to lay these mines, and the other half would go up and take them up. How to take them up, and sometimes you used to have to use your hands and your bayonets. And then you used to also, part of the platoon would set all these booby traps off in the barrack home, and then another section would have to go in and find them, and then demobilise them. And of course we come quite used to doing that.
Using your bayonet, how did you do that to get a mine?
I just used to dig it in more or less at a certain degree, about sideways more or less. And but to tell it, these large round mines, they were quite easy, but they were pretty large. In fact, they were easy to find because they were pretty large, and you could just scrape the soil away, lift them out and turn them over, and then take the detonators out. I mean, those was easily demobilised. But when you come to these S mines, those were deadly because they had like the three prongs on, and if anybody stood on one of them, why, more or less you'd had it. And those were the worst ones, I would think, of the lot.
Were you learning to deal with those?
We were learning to deal with them, but it was very tricky.
How was it done?
Well, we used to have to find them first with our hands, but be very careful, and then lift them, and I think the detonator, if it serves me right, was at the bottom, and you used to have to unscrew them, and then similar to a hand grenade at the bottom, and take the detonator out.
Were there any accidents while you were doing this?
No, of course everything was just, this was all practice, they weren't live, you know. No, it was too risky having them live, but this was just to give us a rough idea. I mean, everything was laid out on a large table in the barrack room, you know. All the different types of mines was laid out, and each one, it was showing you how it was put together and how to dismantle it. And we all learnt that first before we went out and practised in the field.
Mining or booby trapping the hut you were living in?
Yeah.
Was this basically to deal with booby traps rather than mines of that nature?
Well, it was, because I think the thing was, like, they found out that Jerry was booby trapping lots of farmhouses and places like that, where he billeted when he'd been leaving them. He was leaving these booby traps in, like, and we had a good idea what the sergeant was telling us where to work, what to wear and where to find them. And when we found them, well, we knew how to dismantle them. And that's more or less what we were being taught.
You've basically been told or been learnt about German actions and how they themselves prepare things, booby traps and so on.
That's right, yes.
And we have also been told about German weaponry, the kind of weapons they were using against you, or would use against you.
Well, it was only the Spandaus, which we knew, which was wicked. And then, of course, there was his mooring minis and his mortars, which he was spot on with.
And you've been told this at this time?
We were being told this, about the mortars and that, you know.
You mentioned getting 25 pounders across the river. How did you do that?
Well, I remember, I think it was myself and Charlie. In fact, I think I was sitting on the barrel, and Charlie was down below. And when I come to think, this was in January at Saffron Walden. I remember now, January in Saffron Walden, because there was snow on the bottom. So that's when I was at Saffron Walden, in January. And there was, I had like a pontoon taken across, and I had a rope stretched at the other side, and unfortunately it turned over. And I remember me and Charlie went into the water, like, and we were absolutely frozen, and we ran back to the barrack room. And I remember on the way back, Captain Williams stopped, like, and he gave me a pair of gloves. I always remember that when you come to speak about it.
This would again be basically teamwork.
That was more or less teamwork, yes. How to take them across.
Anything else that you were doing with this X platoon?
The S platoon. No, I think that was more or less it. It was more or less mine lifting. And
we're still doing bayonet drills?
No, not there. No, no. All that had gone in the past. I mean, we were fully. What's that?
9th Battalion, of course, had come back from the desert in Sicily.
That's right.
And you'd
yes.
be meeting men who had already done a lot of fighting.
Yes.
What were they telling you?
Well, more or less they were telling us about Sicily, about the Primisoli Bridge and what a rough time it had been, and, you know.
Did this frighten you in any way? Make you afraid?
Well, it didn't really. I mean, I never gave it much thought. Of course, I don't think any of us did at the time. I think, well, I think at that age, you know, I mean, I think that then I would be only about 20, and no, I didn't think much of it.
Were they also giving you advice on how to deal with Germans in particular situations?
Yes, well, eventually from the, as I said, like from the 9th Battalion, I was transferred about 4 days before D-Day to the 6th Battalion, and this was at Nightingale Woods.
So you'd been with the 9th for quite a while?
Yes, and what was happening was, you see, they were getting prepared for D-Day, and they must have been short of men, and they were shifting the men around. And I was transferred to the 6th Battalion under Major Kirby. And the team, what they used to do, they used to team the young soldiers, such as us, with an old soldier. Well, they piled me off with this lad called Bill Beach, who came from Yorkshire. Well, he was an old soldier. Now, he had been in Sicily, and now he was telling me about Primisoli Bridge. And oh, what a heck of a time they had. And he mentioned, I think it was this Major Atkinson there, about what. The type of work he'd done and things like that, and about the Jerry mortars and the machine guns. But it must have been a parachute battalion, I think, the way Bill was telling me. But oh, he said it was terrible, and he used to show me how to dig in and when to dig in, and you know. And of course all that came in very useful when eventually we did go to Normandy.
You said Major Kirby, which company were you in?
C Company. Yes, I was in C Company.
What was the morale of these older soldiers like? They'd already been through a lot of war.
Yes, well, the morale, they didn't seem bothered. At least I got the impression they weren't. They didn't seem to be too upset. Of course, that was no good being upset because we were, as I said, we were under canvas and we had a British guard inside, barbed wire right round, and then we had an American guard outside. In fact, we were being fed by the Americans, and the Americans then, the food was really smashing. You know, we were getting fed on the best. And I mean, I remember then we had, they were showing us all the positions where we had to take. They had all these plastic places where what was in Normandy, which there was all shown. Like in made up in plastic, you know, like a bridge or whatever, or a farmhouse. There's a farmhouse there, and they're showing us everything. Now your positions, you ought to go there, and this company's going there. I mean, everybody knew where they were going to go, providing they were going to land in the proper place, and that was what was happening at the camp.
The older soldiers, were there any going absent without leave?
Well, they couldn't go absent without leave because, as I say, we had a British guard inside and an American guard outside. There was no way anybody could get out. I mean, if they could, I think they would, but they knew we were going there because they were talking about having casualties about 80%. That's what, you know, that was what the rumour was going about, and I think that's what put the wind up majority, like, you know. I mean, well, we didn't know what to expect.
These men were again in an assault division. Did they have any moans, army type groans about the fact that they were going to be first in again,
well,
and other soldiers following out?
Well, they were always saying, the poor Germans again, the 50 day, we always at the front, you know, and the usual caper, it's always us, and the usual, you know, that's the way they went on, but they just accepted it at the finish, because we had no other choice.
What were conditions like in the camp? You've mentioned the food as being good.
Well, the camp, I would say, was, I mean, we were on the canvas then, and the camp was quite good. It's quite good for the length of time we were there.
The fact that you were locked in and couldn't get out at night and couldn't go to places,
well, it didn't
how did they keep you relaxed?
Well, I mean, there was plenty of drink and cigarettes and everything. I mean, and as I said, they were trying to show you where you were going to land and all these different places, what you were going to take.
What was Kirby like, your commanding officer?
Oh, he's a nice chap. Oh, he's very pleasant. I couldn't... And my sergeant was a chap called Sergeant Smith. He was a Cockney. And another great friend of mine was Lance Corporal Charles Passfield.
Were you still a private at this time?
I was still a private, yes. Yes.
At this stage, you still had no fears of what lay ahead?
Well, no, I didn't. I never. I just took everything as it came. I just said, well, what's to be has got to be. There's nothing you can do about it. You just got to accept it. And I think everybody, more or less, we took that attitude. We couldn't.